This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at accountability of the Catholic Church in light of the Pope's recent resignation and pending lawsuits.
It looks like the other shoe is finally falling, and the abuse of the Catholic Church for years is coming home to roost.
We'll take a look at so-called zero-tolerance school policies, which can punish minor infractions with long-standing repercussions for students.
Are those policies necessary? Are they helpful? Are they carried out in a racially neutral way? Do they lead to the school-prison pipeline?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Okay, Heidi and Michael, last week we had a decision by the Supreme Court on the so-called secret court, warrantless wiretapping, etc. Do you think our phones are being tapped at this house that represents Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, Guantanamo detainees?
Three guild members in the room.
I used to be on the security list. I'm not sure I still am, but I'll bet you guys are.
Well, the point is, we're probably all monitored, but we don't have, as the government would say, standing to challenge it in a court of law.
Right. So here's briefly what happened. 5-4 decision. Let me give you a little genesis of it. I'll tell you how it went in a sec. In 2001, after 9/11, President Bush secretly, without us knowing, decided he was going to warrantlessly wiretap Americans and others. Not even go to the secret court.
The FISA court.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. Not even do that. Just do it on his own. Eventually, in 2005, the New York Times, through a man named James Risen, who is still there, exposed the warrantless wiretapping of the president. They waited a year to expose it. Risen had found out about it in 2004. It was carried out by the National Security Agency. They waited because they, of course, consulted the White House and said, would this hurt you? Here's a huge unconstitutional program being carried out by the president on his own, and the New York Times is holding the news. They were looking at an espionage indictment against Risen. They never did it.
They subpoenaed him three times.
But Risen is now again in a proceeding around another issue related.
The book he wrote.
The book, but it's not about wiretapping. It's about something. It's another national security issue. And he has refused to testify so far, and that's on appeal to the appeals court in the Fourth Circuit. But in any case, back to warrantless wiretapping. So after all this malarkey goes on, everybody says unconstitutional, illegal, can't do it. The president could have been prosecuted for it. It's a violation of the law. I remember when Gore was running for vice president or president, he said, you know, this is an outrage and there should be prosecution and it's a violation of the law and all this. They never did it. But instead, Congress, in its great wisdom, decided to make whatever the president did legal and give him a statute to do it. And that's the new act that is now under challenge. Now, we all the human rights organizations, civil liberties, ACLU, Center, challenged this from the very beginning, from starting as soon as we found out about it in 2005. Now the challenge was to the new law, which again allows wiretapping through this special court, FISA court. Was there going to be a challenge that the court could hear, or was the court not going to hear it? Now, what happened 5-4? Michael, do you remember what happened?
They basically threw the rule of law out the window because the Supreme Court said, we're not going to get involved. This is an executive decision, and you people who are complaining about having your phones tapped, your emails tapped, you don't have any standing. We're not even going to listen to you. We're not even going to adjudicate this thing. We're not even going to listen to you. So the highest court in the land says that courts can't be involved. That's throwing the rule of law out the window.
It is, because in the late 60s, we had United States v. United States District Court, which was a case challenging warrantless wiretapping, essentially, by the Nixon administration, and the court then held that the president wasn't above the law.
That was a Center and a Guild case back then. I was at the Center when we litigated it. Arthur Canoy was one of the people who argued it, one of the founders of the Center.
Early 70s.
Right. It was early 70s, that's right, because it was one of the first briefs I ever worked on. But the difference here is, in that case, that was a criminal case, and the government acknowledged they had done wiretapping under the president's, quote, authority, national security to wiretap, and the court said there is no inherent authority, or at least they did in that case. They said there's no inherent authority of the president to wiretap, and that's when they passed all these laws. Now, what happened in this case is the statute's passed, and then a bunch of people get together under the ACLU, and the Senator's case is similar.
And say they suspect their conversations may be subject to monitoring.
Right, because the government criteria say that, like, our clients at Guantanamo and their families overseas
are national security risks,
and they can be wiretapped. So they never had the, quote, smoking gun, but they had as close as you could get. And as the four dissenters said, this is like almost for sure. These guys, this is as likely as any other case we've ever had.
Plus, what happened to the so-called chilling effect that knowing you possibly may be monitored has on your communication?
Right, especially when it's not just a remote speculative chance. This is not speculative. The chances that the center lawyers, that the people in the ACLU case were being monitored were very high. And the court said, no, it's not high enough. You have to actually have the smoking gun, the gun, and it's 5-4. And that was the end of that case. And as Jamil Jaffery, who argued that case in the Supreme Court, and he did better than a lot of people thought, not personally, but just getting four judges on this, he said, this is really the end. It's what you guys have been saying, what Michael said, that you can't we didn't litigate the wiretapping successfully. We're not litigating the rendition programs successfully. We've been unable to get anything on torture, you know, any carrying out of responsibility for torture. That's the center's Maharara case. Any accountability for torture. And we've had a little bit of accountability on some of the stuff on Guantanamo, none on drones. We've lost every case, essentially, with the exception of some of the earlier Guantanamo cases. And, of course, we see Guantanamo still open with 160-some people still there. So we've essentially, the courts have become essentially an adjunct of the national security state in the United States.
A rubber stamp.
It used to be, if the government wanted to do a wiretap, they'd have to go to this secret FISA court.
Right.
40 years ago, they set the thing up. Now, because of the latest Supreme Court ruling saying no standing, the government scoop it all in, you know, like a dragnet scooping in all the fish in the ocean, and then they sort it out. So, of course, they get these communications from lawyers like Michael and the center or the guild. Of course they do. And the Supreme Court said you can't do anything about it.
Well, let's just say that this was a case under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They are going to the court to get this. And we had a program on this earlier, which we can link to, where we talked to somebody about what's allowed under the law. And what's allowed is they can decide they don't. They no longer, under this law, they no longer need to say, I want to wiretap Michael Smith or the Center for Constitutional Rights, but I want to find out about, let's say, WikiLeaks. And I want to find out anything about WikiLeaks. And in the course of doing that, they can wiretap all of us who talk about WikiLeaks, who represent Julian
Assange. It no longer has to be a conversation with a so-called foreign national, which is what FISA was created originally
for. They can just take in information all over. So in that sense, it is like a vacuum cleaner. Yeah. It is technically under the law, but the law is essentially, as you guys have been saying, is a rubber stamp. Now, we've talked about, and we won't get into length here, torture and the decline of empire.
Yeah. Marnia Lazarek.
Comparing what happened in Algeria in 1956 to what has happened in the United States post 9/11, saying these are really parts of a declining empire as they keep trying to hold on and a certain macho-ness to it, et cetera. And I think we're not going to go through that analysis here, but there is part of that going on.
Behind the scenes, we've had some animated conversation about Zero Dark Thirty and other movies. Michael Ratner, you have an update on this?
I mean, we've talked about all this on the show periodically. But the biggest update, of course, and the one positive thing that came out of the Academy Awards, maybe there's a few others, but is Zero Dark Thirty got essentially iced out, did not win the Best Picture, did not win a bunch of other best things, and that's because it was a film made up of lies, essentially. That's probably the main reason it didn't win. But what bothers me, of course, about what did win and what's going on in American culture in particular, but what's really going on in America, is the rehabilitation of the CIA, everything else, torture, drones, and all that. But if I look at the CIA, we have four films. Most of our listeners probably haven't seen all four. I've seen all four. Zero Dark Thirty, Argo, which won the Academy Award, of course, is a celebration of the CIA and its freeing hostages from Iran. Then you have Manhunt, which most people haven't seen yet, which is the so-called true story of getting bin Laden, starring some of the agents. But again, with Jose Rodriguez, one of the people working for the CIA, who was involved, at least knew a lot about it, and then destroyed the tapes of the waterboarding, being the talking head in that movie. So you have those three movies, and then you have a movie from a couple of years ago, The Green Room, that again talks about the CIA and how they were saying, well, there's no weapons of mass destruction and all this. So you have four films that have basically rehabilitated a CIA that in the 70s and 80s, most of us sitting around this table and our friends would have wanted to end and abolish and destroy, because the CIA was then and is still doing today overthrowing governments all over the world, infiltrating unions and other popular groups and destroying them.
And assassinating.
And assassinating people, which it's still doing through the drone program.
Michael, John Kennedy said after the Bay of Pigs disaster that he'd like to tear the CIA up into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. So he even understood the insidious nature of that outfit.
So what does it say that we now have four films which are reflecting a culture of a rehabilitation of the CIA? One, that people are terrified in the country, and therefore they're saying, let the CIA do whatever it wants. But what else does it say, guys?
That the CIA is a good propaganda machine.
I think that part of the reason why there have been no prosecutions, although torturing people is illegal internationally and nationally, is that people are scared to death, and they believe it works, and they let it slide.
I do think the torture scenes in Zero Dark Thirty help normalize that illegal series of actions, and that's a bad thing.
I think Heidi's right, and that is bad, and I do think America accepts it right now. And I do put the fault for that, obviously, at Bush, who authorized it, but at Obama, who has completely failed to prosecute it. And now we see John Brennan, who we've talked about on this program, about to become head of the CIA, a man who knew a lot about the torture program and the waterboarding, and is in charge of the drone program, who couldn't get to be head of the CIA 4 years ago because of his involvement and knowledge about the torture program, and now he's going to be head of the CIA. So there's a normalization in this country. We all know it. Everybody out there knows it. And, you know, that's where we are, guys.
But it's still going on. There was a above-the-cut story in the New York Times last week. Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, barring American troops from the province that abuts Kabul because American troops and Afghanis who they supervise were abducting and torturing Afghan citizens. So it's still going on. And I would argue that had Obama had some courage and prosecuted the lawbreakers when he came into office, that culture of torture would have been stopped, and you wouldn't have had the recent torture in Afghanistan.
It's a different kind of Academy Award event than we saw in the 60s when Marlon Brando or others would get up and take the political opportunity to comment. Now you just don't see any of that.
Now, Michael, when you referred to the New York Times article on the torture in Afghanistan and the failure, you know, you're kicking the U.S. out, you said it was above the cut of the New York Times, right? Now, I have a piece of paper here, and I'm folding it in half. That's the New York Times. Is that a cut, or is that above the fold?
The fold.
Above the fold. Thank you, Michael. I rest my case.
As many listeners may know, so-called zero-tolerance school policies will punish any infraction of a rule, regardless of whether it was an accident or a violation born out of ignorance or extenuating circumstances. For example, schools normally may forbid cell phones or use of profanity. With zero-tolerance, breaking these rules can result in suspension or even expulsion. The policies are promoted to prevent violence and drug abuse in schools. But for years, critics have pointed out their subjective nature. Students targeted by zero-tolerance policies may become less educated by multiple suspensions and expulsion, which can often lead them into the criminal justice system. We talk more about zero-tolerance with Professor Russell Skiba, a professor in counseling and educational psychology at Indiana University. He directs the school outreach practicum in the school psychology program and is a member and lead author of the American Psychological Association's Task Force on Zero Tolerance. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Professor Skiba.
Thanks very much. I'm so pleased to be here.
Now, let's start with an explanation of what is zero tolerance in a school setting.
Zero tolerance grew out of a philosophy of school discipline that really came from the 1980s and 1990s, the period where we believed that because youth violence was accelerating in our communities that we were in real danger of being overwhelmed by that violence in school settings. Interestingly enough, data since then has showed that was never really the case, that rates of disruption in schools have remained relatively consistent over a 30 or 40 year period. But out of that fear grew a response that said, you know, the only way we're going to defend against that and keep our schools safe and our students and teachers safe will be by real tough responding, kind of the Joe Clark with a baseball bat model, that by punishing harder and punishing increasingly minor incidents, we can send a message to kids that certain behaviors simply won't be acceptable, and that will deter other kids and keep the school safer for those that remain.
It sounds somewhat like the so-called broken window theory of policing, where they crack down on...
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the zero tolerance theory came out of broken windows theory of policing.
Was there a particular incident that triggered this? Because obviously in recent years we've had a lot of gun violence in schools, high-profile events. But did something happen in the 80s to bring this about in academic environments?
No, not in particular. It really was more of the case of a practice that started in drug enforcement being adopted by schools. Reagan administration used a program. There's a model in San Diego Harbor where even trace amounts of drugs would lead to confiscation of one's boat and appearance in federal court. That sort of faded out after there were a number of high-profile cases like seizing a Woods Hole oceanographic vessel. It faded out from drug enforcement, but interestingly enough was picked up in schools as that fear grew. I think, you know, there's a bit of a analog to today when there's a fear response, as there was in the 90s and a fear response after some of the school shootings, there does tend to be a belief that we don't have time to look at the data. We just have to act and do anything that's necessary to protect our kids. And while that's a noble impulse and something we all feel for our kids, when we allow ourselves to be driven by fear to ignore some of the data, it's a dangerous way to make policy.
As a consequence of propagating this zero tolerance on the basis of really false fears, what's the harm? What's happened as a consequence?
One of the reactions to zero tolerance has always been those incidents that we all see as ridiculous, where, you know, a kid draws a paper gun and is expelled from school, or the case in Georgia where a girl had a Tweety Bird wallet attached to her backpack with a 2-inch chain, and that was considered a weapon because anything in Cobb County, Georgia, any chain was considered a weapon. We kind of all kind of react in horror to those overextensions. But really, the more central question is, is it effective? You know, an advocate of zero tolerance on the phone here today would say, well, you just don't understand what we face in schools. And sure, we're going to have some occasional overzealous implementation, but, you know, that's probably better than the alternative, our schools being unsafe. So really, the important point is whether it has been found to be effective, whether it makes a difference in promoting school safety or improving student behavior. And a number of major national organizations and quite a few researchers have looked at that issue. The APA, American Psychological Association, put together a zero tolerance task force to look at the effectiveness of zero tolerance. And they found after a year of studying of hundreds of documents that there was no evidence that zero tolerance made any contribution to school safety or improvements in student behavior. Just last week, a national association, American Association of Pediatricians, also put out a statement saying that out-of-school suspension and expulsion are, in fact, risk factors for kids and should be only used when absolutely necessary.
Russ, let me ask you this, because my fear when I started learning about this was that this is just going to grease the skids and more children are going to end up in juvenile homes and prisons than should. Has that been the consequence of this?
Yeah, it's often referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline, the notion that, you know, when we put kids out of school, it puts them more at risk for involvement in the juvenile justice system. And until recently, that was just a model, you know, that we didn't have data on it one way or another. But in fact, in the last few years, there has been a lot of data accumulating that yes, in fact, that's the case. And, you know, it's not a direct line. I mean, we can't say that any kid who is suspended the first time is going to become a hardened criminal. But there are a lot of links there, so that kids who are suspended or expelled are more likely to become disengaged from school. It has a negative correlation with school achievement. And those things probably are responsible for the consistent correlation we see between suspension and failure to graduate or dropout. And then over time, we do see an increased likelihood of involvement with the juvenile justice system. And it's important to recognize that there have been some real controlled studies about that. The Breaking School Rules study looked at 5 years of longitudinal data, every single kid in the state of Texas, and controlled for over 80 demographic variables, and did find that suspension in and of itself increases the likelihood of school dropout and increases the likelihood of involvement with the juvenile justice system. And it's important to recognize that by controlling for all those variables, we can't just say, you know, this was a kid who was more at risk for being suspended anyway, and so, they're going to be more at risk for involvement in the juvenile justice system. This is controlling for all of those variables that predict. So, you know, even kids who are, we would say, are not our frequent flyers, who did not start out as being at risk for dropout or increased contact with juvenile justice, even in those cases, it increases your risk. Sure, you know, our more well-behaved kids are less likely to be involved in juvenile justice, but it even increases the risk for those kids if we use suspension and expulsion.
Russ, speaking of demographics, is any particular segment of the student population disproportionately affected by zero tolerance?
Oh, well, yeah, yes, of course. We've known for a long time that African-American students are disproportionately represented. Since the 1970s, African-American students are more likely to be represented in suspension and expulsion. At that point, data from the Office for Civil Rights showed that they were about twice as likely as white students to be suspended. By the most recent data collection in 2010, that had gone up to African Americans being 3.5 times more likely than white students to be suspended out of school.
Russ, can you be a little more explicit about why African Americans and Latinos seem to be subject to this?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the assumption, and if you go online and blogs, you're going to see this all the time, you know, that, well, of course, they're suspended more. They're from poor families. They come in with poor skills. They're going to have worse behavior. So what would you expect? Well, in fact, our data really don't support that. That kids from disadvantaged backgrounds are disciplined more. But if you put that in an equation with race, race still is a significant contributor to disproportionality, independent of poverty. So in other words, the disparities, yes, poor black kids are more likely to be suspended than poor white kids, but so are middle-class black kids more likely than middle-class white kids and upper-class black kids. And again, the data doesn't support the idea that it's due to African-American different rates of behavior for African-American students. One study lately found that even after teachers had rated the behavior of all of the kids in their classrooms, so that was controlled for, they still tended to refer African American students more often than white students. So those things have not been found. In terms of what has been found to be related, more African American students in a school tends to lead to harsher punishment. And again, that's independent of demographics. So even in a suburban setting, if there's more African-American students at school, there's more likelihood to use harsher punishment. That's a little disturbing. More teachers of color seems to result in reduced rates of disparities. Classroom management appears to have an impact, that differences in classroom management and ability to manage kids' behavior, possibly interacting with cultural mismatch. Do I recognize the behavior of my white kids who are acting out and can go, it's boys will be boys, but you know, as a white teacher, I'm not really familiar with what misbehavior among African American students, and so I may respond real different and escalate issues that didn't necessarily need to be escalated if there was more of a relationship there. So those are some of the things that have been not found or found to be contributing to the disparities.
We're speaking with Professor Russell Skiba at Indiana University. He was a member and lead author of the American Psychological Association's Task Force on Zero Tolerance. My take from what you've said is that this is just part of a larger picture of a society that just wants to put people, discipline them, put them away, particularly if they're people of color. And what kind of suggestions do you have in terms of alternative approaches to this?
You know, I think if we take a 30,000-foot view and look at the data, you know, I think there are disturbing pieces. The fact that any time there's more African Americans in a school, that school is more likely to use harsh punishment. That is disturbing. But you know, when we get down to the ground level, I don't know. I don't think we can say that, you know, all that administrators and teachers are really just are looking to put kids away. You know, when I work in schools, I don't have the sense that, you know, people relish the fact that, you know, they can move more kids through to suspension and expulsion or get them out. Where it comes down to is that folks don't understand the alternatives. There is a need to keep our schools safe and well-disciplined. I mean, it is true that, you know, kids can't learn in an environment of chaos. And I think the issue is more that folks don't know what else to do. They are unaware of the alternatives that might be out there for them. And so as a result, they simply do what they know how to do, what they see themselves as having to do. And we find that in our work, when we work with schools and help them increase their options so that they're, you know, looking at programs that help them reduce suspension, those things tend to go down on their own over time.
Russ, if you can give us just a few specifics of ideas that have worked, be it from mediation to creative programs in schools, what's
sure.
happening on that front?
Sure. You know, in general, I think it's really productive to think about there being no one simple solution that's going to move us away from overuse and suspension expulsion, but to think instead in terms of three levels. First of all, at the universal level, that we put programs in place like conflict resolution or positive behavior support that make clear the expectations for all kids and teach kids expectations. And in terms of conflict resolution and other social emotional learning programs, you know, actually teach kids what they need to do to manage their own emotions and to get along with one another. And then at a second level, there are going to be kids who are at risk, who come in with deficiencies in behavior. And for those kids, you know, programs around, say, emotional self-regulation, around anger management, that teaching them how to productively deal with their emotions, or mentoring. You know, we know that a lot of these issues come from kids who are alienated from school, so mentoring to pull kids back in. And then at a third level, once we have kids who are engaging in violence and disruption, things like in-school programs or functional behavioral assessment and individual behavioral programs that enable us to come up with alternatives for those kids. So that we have a variety of programs that have been shown to really be more effective. And what those things do is, they're building up our muscles. If we don't engage in our prevention muscles, then those atrophy, and we don't have any recourse but to engage in suspension. If we put a variety of programs in place, we're building up those muscles for helping develop a strong climate for our school and really engaging students rather than pushing them out of school.
Russ, it's been a pleasure to have you on. I wanted to mention that you're co-author with Reese Peterson of the book The Dark Side of Zero Tolerance: Can Punishment Lead to Safe Schools? If people are interested in learning more about this topic, would you refer them to a website?
There are a few websites. They can look up the APA Zero Tolerance Task Force report online. We have quite a number of publications on this at the Equity Project at Indiana University. The Civil Rights Project at UCLA has quite a number of works on this.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. This is eye-opening in many respects, and we thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been really a pleasure talking.
Thanks, Russ. Good luck.
Okay, thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Continue to look at accountability within the Catholic Church for widespread, systematic sexual assault and violence against tens of thousands of victims, mainly children. The Church's main priority, as it has been shown, has been to protect itself and its power instead of ensuring the protection of the children in the Church and others vulnerable to abuse by priests. Now that Pope Benedict XVI has resigned, international prosecution will be easier for national systems of justice. The Center for Constitutional Rights, in September of 2011, filed a lawsuit with the International Criminal Court on behalf of the organization Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP. The suit was against the Pope and other high-level Vatican officials for crimes against humanity. The plaintiffs provided additional documentation. The prosecutor is currently reviewing the evidence. We'll speak first with Mary Ward Kaplan, the head of SNAP in New York. Mary, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Mary, we're glad to have you today on Law and Disorder. And can you tell us, to begin with, what your title is with SNAP and what SNAP is?
Sure. My title is I'm the New York director for SNAP. SNAP is really a network of survivors who try to help each other. And we try to help each other deal with the experience of having been raped or abused or sodomized by authority figures. Specifically, we started with clergy, and now we include survivors who have been abused by any authority figure.
Really? By any authority figure? You mean even teacher or like people in, like, you know, there was these recent cases in Brooklyn with some Hasidic Jews. You would include other religions as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rabbis,
wow.
Ministers.
Good for you guys.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that because, you know, we didn't just want it to focus on the one area, and it's going on all over, of course.
Mary, you're shaking my faith.
Well, that is the wonderful thing about when a network of people get together and start to help each other and look at an issue and realize it is not just here. It is not in one religion. It is not in one place. It is not in the United States only. And as we learn these things, hopefully we'll all evolve to reach out to all the people we need to reach.
Well, good. Now, we wanted to talk about some of the recent events and how they've impacted you and SNAP in particular. Of course, the first is the Pope's resignation, which by the time the show is broadcast will have happened. In fact, it happens, I think today's Wednesday we're recording. It happens tomorrow, Thursday. And he gave his little speech today about being in a boat on a lake and all that, which I'm sure you looked at. But as a result of the resignation, as a result of the work of SNAP over some 20-some years you've been in existence, the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit, there seems to be a lot going on right now on the issue of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Can you give us a sense of what is going on right now? We see a couple of cardinals are getting in trouble now. One's had to resign. Another one, they're saying, should they all be in the conclave, et cetera, et cetera.
I think one of the wonderful things that has happened is there's certainly been more attention toward this. And the reason for that is many, many things, I think. There was a time when print journalism especially wouldn't touch the church. They were really able to act under secrecy. It was considered not a good idea to print anything bad about the Catholic Church. It is a very powerful institution, and it was taking a terrible chance to do that. I know when SNAP, and along with CCR and the New York Times, questioned Cardinal Dolan about some monies he had spent before declaring bankruptcy so they wouldn't have to pay survivors, he immediately reacted with saying SNAP and lawsuits at the International Criminal Court, and the New York Times were all scurrilous. So, and that's today. So long ago, it was really very difficult for print journalists to do that. I think with the onset of more light being shined on it, of more people taking action and bringing civil suits when they can, of SNAP partnering with CCR and being able to bring the case with so much evidence to the International Criminal Court, I think this has enabled and empowered more journalists, television journalists, radio, social media has been another wonderful help to us. And there's no denying, I don't think anymore, it's out there, and it's out there for people to know.
I'm curious, when there's a rise in media attention around things like the Pope's resignation, do you see an increase in victims coming forward and reaching out to SNAP?
Immediately. It's very interesting. Monday when the Pope resigned, when the news came out of the Pope resigning, there were both many phone calls for media interviews, followed by many phone calls from survivors, and a really surprising amount. And this happens each time in Los Angeles when the 2,000 pages of papers were released about Cardinal Mahoney and the cover-up. Survivors are very ashamed to come forward, and I think one of the biggest reasons I hear, and certainly that I experienced as a survivor, was the idea that you will not be believed. Who will be believed for this cardinal, this powerful institution, or this individual?
And stop me if this is too personal, but when you first got involved in this, who was it that you complained to, and how did you try to get publicity about what happened to you?
When I was abused, it was the 60s, and I was young, and my father was dying, and the priest suggested that if I did certain things, a miracle might be wrought, and my father would live. After my father died, and the miracle wasn't wrought, and I understood more what was done, I tried to go to the pastor of the local church, and he did not believe me and suggested to my mother, who was very religious and overwhelmed herself at the time, that I was in a state of deep grief. After that time, I really did nothing with it. There were no places that I knew of to turn. I was raised in a very Catholic culture. I went to an all-Catholic school. I couldn't go to the nuns. I already went to the priest. the politicians, and I grew up in Jersey City, were all Catholic. So eventually I got therapy. I married. I had children. I tried to put it in part of my history that happens and deal with it as best I could. But what happened in 2002 in Boston was really the thing that made me become an activist. When I found out that Cardinal Law had hidden all these things and covered up, to know that all these years later it was still going on, was I thought it was an aberration, what happened to me. I never spoke of it to people, so I didn't know other people had gone through this. But when I found out in 2002 that this was still going on, I was shocked and enraged and hurt.
Mary, that's a disturbing story. It dawned on me when you mentioned that the nuns' involvement. We haven't really talked about that. Do a lot of survivors go to nuns sort of as a first level of comfort? And if so, is your story similar in that fashion, that there's no response?
I think what I've learned recently, the St. John's School for the Deaf.
Milwaukee.
That they were taken care of by nuns. Most of us were schooled by nuns, or if we were in boarding school, there were nuns there. And you just had the sense that they had to know what was going on. They were very subservient and always gave the message, Father knows best, not to quote the TV show, but the priest knows best. The priest is the ultimate authority. The priest is another Christ coming to the classroom. So I never went to the nuns. And the fact is that some nuns were abusers themselves. So it was a very difficult situation. It was being in not only the priest who might abuse you, but being in the whole culture of the nuns, the priests, the Monsignor, the politicians. It really made for one bubble up there all together, and I'm kind of outside of this circle.
Mary, if someone in our listening audience wants to contact an organization for help or to expose any of these crimes, what would you suggest?
The first thing I would suggest is not to go to the archdiocese or not to go to the priest. Mm-hmm. One of the terrible things they do is that they often welcome the person, delay tactics until a statute of limitation has run, and that's happened very often, and they use their words against them. What I would suggest is, if you can and if you're able, to go to the authorities. That's the law enforcement is the agency that should be handling these. Very often that's not possible because the person doesn't feel like they can do it or a statute of limitation has run. Then we suggest that, and in both cases they have to go to the authorities, they contact us at snapnetwork.org. And I would encourage anyone who's listening who's gone through this, and I would also encourage whistleblowers who find themselves wanting to do the right thing but very much alone in how to go about it. So I would encourage anyone who needs direction or help with this.
What are your hopes for the SNAP lawsuits that's going on now? What would you like to see come of it?
You know, people have asked that very, very frequently, and I think one of the things that's happened already, the court is looking at this very seriously. They met with us, and this is a court that doesn't have immunity. It's been very trying on the soul and spirit to know that there is immunity within the Vatican, and so that was hopeful. What I'd like to see is accountability and some sense of a change that this will never happen again, and I'd also like to know that even now, before this case is heard, that in a certain sense, presenting the evidence and bringing it, that the sex scandal is already on trial, and we are creating an atmosphere where people can come forward and add to the evidence in some cases.
Mary, we really appreciate both your personal journey on this as well as particularly the work of SNAP. And I guess I have a final question. We began sort of thinking about it. SNAP has now expanded to not just be abuse by priests, but other religions as well as other kinds of hierarchies. And yes, reporting it, getting prosecutions, et cetera, is obviously crucial. But it seems to be endemic to these kinds of closed systems. And is there other ways that you're thinking about this? I mean, yes, reporting it is very important, but something's going on in all these closed systems that just makes it endemic in a way. I don't know what else to say.
There is a culture of secrecy, and there is certainly, yes, you're right, it is endemic in places where the power is so great that people fear that we can't do anything about it. But I think we are showing by shattering that culture of secrecy, and that's what speaking out, in some cases bringing lawsuits, and in some cases having conversations like we're having right now, that helps shatter the secrecy and have accountability. And I think that's how we can stand up to these powerful institutions.
I agree with you. I think it's been remarkable in the last few years, and to see what's now happened with these cardinals all over the world being in trouble, having to resign, is a testament to the courage of people like you who've stood up and to SNAP.
We've been speaking with Mary Kaplan from the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP. You can reach them at snapnetwork.org, snapnetwork.org. Mary, you're really a heroine of ours. Keep up the good work, and thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We go now to speak with Attorney Pam Spees, Senior Staff Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has a background in international crime and human rights law. Pam, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
We've had you here before. We've had your clients from SNAP, which is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And we want to talk about what's going on with sexual abuse, the church, your lawsuit against the Pope. Remind our listeners what kind of lawsuit you are doing and who you represent, and then we'll get into what seems to be a growing controversy around the Pope and the College of Cardinals.
Sure. Well, in September 2011, we filed a complaint with the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, asking him at the time, now her, to investigate and prosecute the four highest level officials at the Vatican for their role in basically creating the policies and practices that church officials follow around the world, which really serves to both conceal the ongoing and widespread sexual violence against children and vulnerable adults. But even more than conceal, these policies and practices really serve to perpetuate it. And so we filed that in September 2011 on behalf of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, which is a network that has actually been around for about 24 years now. It started as just a very small group of people who were coming together to support each other who'd had these experiences. And they now have over 12,000 members in, I believe, 8 different countries.
Tell me, what were you asking the court to do, and what's happened, and what do you think now that the Pope is resigning?
Well, we were asked, basically what we did was we filed this complaint along with 22,000 pages of documentation and evidence that's been gathered in different countries around the world, which really shows how these practices and policies work and how the high-level officials at the Vatican are really integrally involved. And so basically we're asking for a criminal investigation and prosecution. Where it stands now is that they're still reviewing all of that evidence. We obviously gave them a lot to look at, and we followed it up about 6 months later with more evidence that had come to light just since we filed the case. And what we're hearing is that apparently there is concern on the part of Vatican officials that this, as well as other efforts to really bring accountability to Rome for this system of sexual violence, is having an impact. It's certainly impacting their decisions in terms of how to handle the resignation, where he'll be living, the kinds of conversations they're having with officials in the Italian government, and that sort of thing.
Let me stop you there for a second, because I did read a story. This was a Reuters story that gave 3 reasons as to why the Pope is going to remain in the Vatican or in Italy. And one of the reasons was very explicit, saying he was afraid of conceivably being indicted or arrested. on the grounds of the sexual abuse that he tolerated or or more. What's your thought about that?
I think two things about that. I think one, it's been a really important moment for survivors and advocates who've been working for decades around the world, often risk, you know, at great personal sacrifice and risk to bring these issues to light. And I think what we're seeing in that statement and in these moments is that their work is having an impact. It's impacting, you know, these decisions and Vatican decisions and his decisions. And that's this is a really important moment. I think that one of the things we said immediately after the resignation is that in some ways his resignation does create more possibility and opportunity for holding him accountable, specifically in national levels, where the fact that you have a sitting head of state could actually be a bar to a prosecution or a civil case. That's not as relevant in the International Criminal Court context because the ICC did away with any of those immunities. And so, you know, it's less relevant at that level, whether he's serving in an official capacity or not. But I think it certainly does open up a lot of opportunities at national levels to begin looking into this and digging into it in a deeper way.
Since the resignation was announced, it's almost like another shoe dropped. I mean, we see, I guess it's the cardinal from Scotland, maybe you can talk about that, has resigned. Mahoney, who was formerly the cardinal from the West Coast in the United States, he is being criticized by the person who took his job, very heavily criticized. And then, of course, not criticized enough is our own cardinal in New York, Dolan, who apparently was involved. Mm-hmm. So you can start with any of those three, but it seems to be people getting accused of it or resigning because of it or it becoming more public.
Well, look, I think there's a point to be made that Mahoney, and we've known this for years, and it's just all been confirmed with a release of tens of thousands of pages of documentation in January, which really showed quite clearly the extent to which he was shielding priests from persecution, you know, helping to obstruct justice. I mean, just the whole array. But it's important not to fall into the trap of thinking that he was doing this in isolation. You know, it's easy to scapegoat him now, but he's really part of a system, and any number of cardinals that will be selecting the next pope have done similar things. They have engaged in cover-up, and in fact, we'll be filing a report to the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child tomorrow, which really sets out that you have to, you know, understand the way that the system of hierarchy works and the way that different cardinals have been elevated, and in large part, it appears, because they were so successful in covering up. So Mahoney is not an isolated figure. I think that, as you said, Cardinal Dolan has done any number of things, and one of the most controversial that came out last year was that he authorized payments to accused priests to silently go away. And tens of thousands of dollars to do that, and that was, you know, church funds going to pay that. You know, three other cardinals that we've named in the complaint, along with Ratzinger, Cardinal Levada, also from the U.S., has had his share of cover-ups, and Cardinal Sodano, who's actually the former Secretary of State under Pope John Paul II, has been involved in two of the more notorious cover-ups. And then Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, who's now the Secretary of State serving under Ratzinger, you know, has communicated very clearly that he doesn't believe that bishops and higher church officials should be cooperating with civil authorities when it comes to even admitted serial rapists in their congregation. And that's, you know, that's the kind of culture we're dealing with. And it's important to understand we're not just talking about a few bad apples. It is the culture of sexual violence that is built up within the church.
Hierarchical nature of it. It's like Standard Oil or the United States Marine Corps, totally top down and arrogant about any challenge to their power. I'm just curious, Pam, because you've got your ear to the ground on this. What's your feel for why Cardinal Ratzinger, now the Pope, why he resigned? Is it just old age and he's getting tired, or do you think it was the cumulative scandals of the Vatican Bank and then the cover up of the children abused by priests? I mean, what's your take on that?
I don't know. I hate to even speculate, and I think it's probably a combination. But, you know, we do know that in January, there had been an inquiry, a commission that was investigating the system and cover up in Germany within the church, and it was brought to an abrupt halt last month. And so, you know, it makes you wonder what more is going to come to light. I think what we're going to be seeing over the next few weeks and months is more revelations, because, you know, I think this is on people's minds. I think as much as the Vatican tried to communicate at the moment of his resignation that this really was about his age and his health, I think it speaks volumes of the work that survivors around the world have done, that the immediate assumption was that it had something to do with the culture of sexual violence that is built up around the church. So I think we won't know for a while, but I do think I suspect we'll be seeing more revelations come to light.
Yeah, well, you're seeing the first pope in 715 years resigning.
That's right.
And I have to believe that in part it's due to the good work of SNAP.
As a summary, can you tell us what you see as the next steps? You said something about filing a report with the UN, the ICC.
Well, first of all, with respect to the complaint we filed at the ICC, we're going to continue to build the evidence and lodge it there and hope that we get, you know, a good decision from the ICC prosecutor. We're also going to be looking at different national jurisdictions that have jurisdiction over crimes against humanity in a way that complements the ICC, because really the ICC is supposed to be a court of last resort. And, it, you know, the idea is that it gives national systems the first opportunity to really build accountability at that level. And so we'll be looking there too. The piece that's important about the filing we're submitting tomorrow to the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child is that the committee has ordered the Holy See to report to it this year. And this will be the first time that an international body with any kind of oversight over the Holy See will be weighing in and taking it and making the Holy See answer questions about the crisis of child sexual abuse in the church. And I think it's important to understand that the Holy See actually ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child in the 90s. It filed its first report, never mentioned anything about child sexual abuse by clergy, even though we now know, looking back, that they had their hands full at the time of these cases. And we're beginning to deal with the fact that these things were starting to bubble up into the public sphere in Canada and Ireland. And so it's taken, well, 20 years almost for the Holy See to, first of all, it had to be required to file another report, and now it's having to answer questions about the system. You know, we're going to be trying to help the committee understand how this stuff has worked so that they're asking the right questions.
Pam, thank you very much, and keep pressing on this case. Once again, you're out there way before others really realized the responsibility of the Pope. What's it called? The old Inquisition Committee that the Pope was on. What's it called?
The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
And they're the ones that, I guess, enforce or actually failed to enforce the law.
Thank you very much, Pam.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.